First of all, I will ask you to name yourself, give us a brief resume of your path from music to composition to, that's the first question.
All right. So I am Alcides Lanza. We are at the Schulich School of Music at my office. And today is February the 11th?
11th, yeah.
Okay. 2008. So this is the first interview. That really is a tricky question. How did I get into music and electronic music? Okay, let's see if we can do it point by point.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I start.
Yeah, but we.
From wherever.
Yeah.
So one important thing is that I was very sick as a child when I was 4.5 years old. I have a kidney infection. That's called nephritis, the rognon.
Yeah.
And it was 1933, because I was born in 1929, and there were no antibiotics. So we were living with my parents in the countryside in a very, very small a town, 2,000 people, only one doctor, Dr. Simonetti. And he cured me basically with ice packs, rest for a long time, told my parents I couldn't eat with salt whatsoever, no salt, and I don't remember the rest. But the thing is that he says, this kid cannot play soccer, cannot ride a bicycle, should not exercise, should not run, until I will say, basta, enough. 10 years passed, okay? Yeah. But my rognon, the kidneys, are perfect all the way to today. So my parents didn't know what to do with me, because my brother, 2 years older than me, will go and play soccer with his friends, and I was there, and I had to stay inside. So they tried to, they didn't send me to school. Easy to explain, because my mother was the headmistress of a grammar school in the same building where we were living. And everyone in the family was, except my father, was a teacher. So they taught me at home. I was 6 years old, I was reading books. So they, my mother tried different things, aquarelle. So I started painting. I still have a very good hand about that. And at some point, maybe when I was 7.5, they discovered in the little town there was a music teacher. So she would let me practice at her piano 1 hour, 3 times per week, and then the class will happen. I think the teacher knew nothing. But I fell in love with the instrument. Now, sorry to go on the anecdotical part, but this is true.
It's quite important also.
My father was a very heavy smoker of black cigarettes, 43. That was a brand name, 43, Carantrois.
Yes.
He died young because of the cigarette smoke. But those cigarettes, they came with a coupon. And it was like a raffle, like a lottery.
Yeah.
And if you managed to match whatever, I don't know what it was, 3 of the same kind, there was some money. The family was poor. So I don't know how much they got, but...
Be careful with your hand.
Probably, I will guess, like today would have been $4,000 or $5,000. Okay? So they paid debts. A new suit for my father, a new dress for my mother. And about the kids, they asked my brother and me, what do you want? And my brother say, a new bicycle. He got it. I was 9 years old by then. And they say, what do you want? I want my own piano. So they bought a piano. So I had a piano at home. At that time, we were already going to school in Rosario, a much larger town, 1 hour away, because my parents was asked to the kids to have better instruction. So my brother and me, we used to live with my grandmother in this large town, and that's where the piano went. because we were spending 9 months of the year going to school there, and only the summer, 3 months, back to the small town, visiting mama and papa every weekend, blah, blah, blah. So I had the piano at home, and I started playing, improvising, you name it, better teachers, okay?
Yeah.
So I started in music as a pianist. And at one point, I was studying already with a so-called Russian pedagogue who was living in Buenos Aires, not in Rosario. That's 4.5 hours away. But he accepted me in his class. I was maybe 16 or 17. And I thought I was going to be another Horowitz, said only piano playing. You name it, Beethoven sonatas, Mozart sonatas, lots of Schumann, the most difficult pieces, Etudes Symphoniques, Kreisleriana, all played in public. I was having a career as a pianist. But let me rewind the tape. My high school, I finished grammar school in the large town when I was 10 and a half.
Yeah.
Because I was taught at home, and I must have been a bright kid,
I suppose.
I was skipping grades. I was ahead. I was reading book. I was ahead of the other kids. So I never did first, second, third grade. I started directly in fourth grade.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So I must have taken some examination. I don't know. So when I finished grammar school, I was 10 and a half. And the family has decided that I will take the family profession, which was be a teacher. But I was rebellious. I didn't like the idea. So you had to take an entrance examination, and I didn't do it very well. I don't remember anymore if intentionally or not. So the chargé d'affaires was my uncle, who was my mother's brother, an Argentinian writer and poet, tremendous influence on me. He was like a second father. So he said, listen, I'll say this. They are only going to take 200 kids for the teacher's school. You got the number 225. So we don't know if you're going to be accepted or not. You had to take another exam on another school. The only one available at the last minute was... I'm doing the soundtrack company, was the so-called industrial school, a technical school. And I did excellent entrance examination, so I got in there. 6 years career, extended high school.
Okay.
The first 4 years were common to everyone. Everyone took the same discipline, including technical drafting and drawing.
Okay. Yeah,
architects.
Yeah.
The fifth and the sixth year, you have to choose between construction, bricks, cement, buildings, mechanics, like diesel motors, oil. I was a pianist. Okay.
I
was very worried about my hands. Or electricity, electronics. So I chose electronics. 2 more years of drafting and technical drawing, and I got my degree. And when I got a diploma, I gave it to my mother. My father was already dead. I have never seen that diploma ever again. And I took 2 years of architecture. Architecture. So in total, I have done 8 years of technical practice. And that, you were asking me, influences. All my scores, all my written music, with or without electronics, I always do them on papier transparent. The architect's paper. I have my portable table with the groove, so you can put your ruler there in any direction. And I always do it in ink. And to today, I still go and buy my architect pens. I never done, not even a sketch. I never do the score on pencil. Never. Directly in ink and directly copying from my head.
Because you have this training.
Yes. And I like the way it looks. I mean, I cannot even, for the Canada Council, when I had to send scores with a pseudonym, it's ridiculous for me.
Yeah. Eh?
Because everyone knows my style. They often score, they say, this is Alcides Lanza. It's unique. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's why there is so much graphism in my music, okay?
Awesome.
In the visual representation. But now let's get back to, I'm 17 years old, I'm finished with this electronics degree and doing 2 years, less than 2 years of architecture. And then I thought about it and I told my mother, this is not for me. I just like to do music, piano. And I don't know if she puts any objections or not, but I quit architecture and continue studying piano privately. Very soon someone told me, you know, you should know more about harmony and form and other things. So I tried at least one music school, out of which I never graduated for very, very anecdotal reasons. The one I will share with you is that the teacher doing history of arts, when dealing with the Babylons and the Assyrians and etc., etc., he was an architect, by the way, spoke very, very badly against the Jewish people who are in near that area.
Yeah, because there was a...
In the class, we were 20 people. There were 3 girls, all Jewish, who were very good friends of mine, all studying piano with that Russian pedagogue, who was also Jewish. So I raised my hand and made some objections, and this guy expelled me from his class. So that was part of the reason why, even if I finished to the end the studies, I never graduated. So I'm there, I'm 20 years old, I do not have a diploma in music, but I moved to Buenos Aires and got a job, the Jewish publishing company gave me a hand, adopted me, gave me a job, and I had money. I didn't want to go to the official music school, so I paid my teachers to teach me.
By yourself?
By myself. So I have a teacher for composition who also did harmony and counterpoint and form, another one for conducting at the Teatro Colón, no less. Okay. I have my piano teacher, so I did my own conservatory. Even today it's possible in Buenos Aires. What you have to think, Mario, is the rebound, the influence of the Spanish Civil War in the late 30s and the Second World War. So many people have to run away from Europe.
Oh, that's right.
Many musicians ran away from Europe and they went to Brazil, to Mexico, and many went to Buenos Aires. Buenos Aires was already a humongous city and the attraction was there. And when they arrived, some of those people were already 40, 50 years old. So they couldn't compete with the locals. They didn't have diplomas. They had to teach privately.
Oh, okay. That's the point. Yeah, yes. I see. So there was a lot of possibility to have
lots of possibilities, yes. And the best, la creme de la creme.
Yeah, I see you study with Ginastera. And
yes, that came later. The private instruction in composition was Julián Bautista, who was a Spanish composer that had to run away from the Spanish Civil War and Franco. And this Russian pedagogue, the name was Rubin Ehrlich for piano instruction. He was Russian, but at the beginning of the Second World War, he was living in Vienna as assistant to, I don't know, some very famous piano teacher that came from the Busoni school, etc. Leschetizky or one of those, I don't know. He was young, he has a wife and a kid. The Nazis came, they killed his family, so he had to run away. Went to Buenos Aires. Actually, he thought he was going to Brazil You know, sometimes you don't speak the language too well. Ended up in Argentina. So he was a fantastic guy. So I did that type of schooling. So obviously at some point, maybe when I was 18, I started writing music. Okay? And I also started fooling around with machines for recording. The first one was my brother, who have obtained a record player to play records. Okay, but I don't know if it was DC current or some mystery. He figured out that if the stylus was perfectly perpendicular, he could play the record from the center to the edge. So he showed me, he was older than me, that you could play things backwards. Okay. Mm. Maybe he changed the polarity of the current.
Something
like that. So the long spiral, instead of from the outside to the center, he read it from the center to the out.
So you begin to know that there was a possibility in electronic
treatment. But I also remember another thing that intrigued me with pianos. I had asked almost every one of those young piano teachers, where are the sounds in between one key and the next? Yes. So where are they? In a way, I was suspecting microtones. I didn't even know the word. But if this is C and this is C sharp,
where is the rest?
Where is the thing in between? And of course, these piano teachers in the little town, they thought I was crazy. Okay, so I was interested in that type of thing. And my first tape recorder, probably 1950, 52, was a Geloso. Do you ever hear that brand name? Italian.
It
kind of portable. It was terrible. The sound quality, you wouldn't believe how bad it was. But I did something. And then I bought secondhand a Grundig.
Oh.
Half track.
At this
half
time.
Track mono.
In the middle of the 50, right?
Probably 1950.
So you was very...
And this tape recorder had three speeds. Had 7.5, 3 3/4,
and
1 7/8.
Yes.
So whatever I recorded, I could record or playback and then switch to the others for listening, for experimentation. The microphone that came with that Grundig was also, for the time, very high quality. I could only afford it because it was secondhand. I bought it used. Now, 63 and 64, I obtained a fellowship to study at the Ditela Institute. That was directed, it was the brainchild of Alberto Ginastera, and was supposed to have an electronic studio. The fellows chosen from all the countries in Latin America, we were 12 in total, were chosen with a jury, etc., to expose them to live in Buenos Aires. People came from Peru, from Mexico, from Brazil. I was a local, okay, but the others had to travel. The airfare was paid for the fellow, if the guy was, or the girl, if they were married, including the family, and $200 per month stipendium. $200 at that time, it was like $2,000 now. It was a very generous fellowship. So each one could devote himself or herself completely to study for 2 years in Buenos Aires. My teachers were Olivier Messiaen, Yvonne Loriot for advanced piano playing, because was the wife of Messiaen, Luigi Dalla Piccola, Ginastera, Bruno Maderna for electroacoustic music, except the laboratory was not ready. So he only lectured with long play records and analysis. And there was one more teacher. Yes, the Jan Malipiero, not Gianfrancesco, the nephew of Gianfrancesco, who was teaching 12-tone music. So Messiaen came for 3 months to instruct us like this, or in the morning, ragas and talas from India.
Oh, yeah.
Every day of the week. He wanted to start at 7 in the morning with the Latinos. Yeah. Success the scandal. No one showed up. So they changed to 9:30 or something like that, because he wanted to go to Le Bois de Palermo in Buenos Aires at 3 in the morning to listen to the birds waking up and taking notes, and then he would have his breakfast and be ready to teach. That was Olivier Messiaen in Buenos Aires. In the afternoon, analysis of his music, his own compositions. Dalla Piccola and Ginastera was composition, Malipiero 12-tone music, and Moderna electronic music. Fantastic. Okay.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Now, the laboratory wasn't ready. They also had an engineer who taught us electronics, because the part of the foundation money came from the Rockefeller Foundation, so they bought Ampexes.
Mm-hmm.
So all the machinery arrived in time, but they forgot that the cyclage in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, is different. Mm-hmm. Here is 60 hertz, over there is 50. Yeah. So all the machines were running too slow. They couldn't use it.
I see.
To the extent that I'm very proud of myself, because now they are the detail doesn't exist, but they are trying to rebuild the memories.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I was there in May playing concerts, and I met the people who are doing this, and we discovered that the first 2 years of concerts of the fellows at the Ditela were recorded with my Grundig, and it's the only record in existence, so you better use it. Because in desperation, Ginastera told me, the machines work badly. We cannot use them for recording. And then somehow he knew about my Grundig and said, can you bring the Grundig? One for Alcides.
Yeah,
very good. So over at that time, 63 and 64, I was already composing not electronic music, just instrumental music, but compositions that survive, and some were very, very advanced. And the relationship with Ginastera wasn't easy, because me and probably other fellows, we have crazy ideas, and he was too straight.
Okay? Yeah.
But somehow we survived. And he was a very close friend of Aaron Copland. And Copland had already been in several times in Buenos Aires, but probably around 1959-1960, I was not a student of Ginastera, private student, but I was a very close friend of Gandini, Tauriello, his best private students. So whenever there was a reason for a party at Ginastera's place, I got invited. So when in this, before the Ditela, when Copland was there, Ginastera organized a meeting of young composers to show scores or play music for Copland. So Copland knew me. So during the 2 years of the Ditela, Copland was invited by Ginastera to go for a month and do 4 lectures on contemporary music. And he did. Lecture number 4 was on computer music.
And you do it?
He did it.
He did it.
Yes. So the first contact, I use CEC fellows listening, the first contact I have with computer music in 1963 was thanks to Aaron Copland, who played and analyzed examples by Lejar and Hiller, the from Illinois, that first Iliac suite and all that. I learned that via Aaron Copland. I think it's beautiful.
It's incredible.
So there was another party before Copland went back to New York at the Ginasteras. And I was there, and I show ginastera is the same. What I was doing was a quartet for four French horns, which he loved. Not ginastera. Ginastera thought I was crazy, and I had to defend my point, and I say, Maestro, Richard Strauss wrote for four French horns, and Robert Schumann wrote for four. Why not me? And then he let me do it. Eventually, he loved that piece. Ginastera took it on lectures that he did in the States and Europe as an example. But in any case, the meeting took place, and Copland asked me, well, he says, what are you going to do in a few months? The detail is finished for you. Are you going to go to Europe? Said, no, no. It was very clear for me. I'm not interested in Europe. I'm looking north. I like what I feel. It comes from the United States. Varese is there. Okay. I heard that there is electronic music there. I didn't know much. Harry Parch is there. John Cage. That's what I wanted. So Copland said, have you thought about the Guggenheim Fellowship? And I say, yes, Maestro Copland, I already applied twice, and I got negatives. And then Copland said, well, apply again, but you put my name as a reference. And I got the fellowship that took me to New York. Once I was in New York, only then I became aware how important was the name of Copland within the Guggenheim business.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, that's right.
Whatever Copland said took place. So thanks to Copland, I left Argentina and I went to New York to study electronic music. Let me also rewind a little here. At the end of the detail, I did one tape composition, but it was not mine. I had a piano duet with another composer pianist called Armando Krieger. It was the duo Krieger-Lanza. Okay. We played many concerts. We did a tour from Washington all the way to Peru and Chile, etc. We were very, very active. And he wanted to do one of his compositions called Contrastes for two pianos and tape. But he didn't know how to make the tape. And then he said, Alcides, you got the Grundig tape recorder. I thought I will do my piece at the laboratory at the Ditella, but it's not ready. We cannot use it. And I had to do it. So this is what happened. He had the score for the two pianos completely written out. And he had half a page with instructions how to make recordings of unusual sounds from the piano at the Ditella. So I brought my Grundig tape recorder, and I followed his instructions. We have some baguettes and some instruments. We scratch the strings, bang it. So I organized all the sounds for Armando Krieger, not for my music. And then, I don't know how, but following his instructions, he says, oh, play this at half the speed, this at double the speed, play this backwards, etc. Cut 2 seconds here, 1 second there. I don't know how I managed to splice. No one taught me how to splice. I think I was using Scotch tape, something like that. And the composition exists. The first composition of electroacoustic music with splicing and recording done by Alcides Lanza was the tape part for the Armando Krieger piece.
And without any knowledge, in fact, or a knowledge you just acquire by yourself.
I knew a little with the same chap, Armando Krieger.
But you don't have access to the equipment. That's
no.
What I mean.
No.
That's why there was no filtering. There was no delay. No, just recording and manipulation of this recording.
I probably managed to do a tape loop. Probably I have to borrow a second machine to be able to copy. Playback and copy on the other one. I have no mixer, no filters. He wasn't asking for that because he didn't know either. Okay, so he accepted whatever I could offer as technique manipulation. But the composition exists. And he is still happy with it. But that was my first practice. We knew a little bit more of certain contemporary tendencies because Armando Krieger and me, we have had from 1960 until 1965 our own radio program for new music in Radio Municipal in Buenos mm-hmm. Aires, which was housed inside the Teatro Colón. It meant that we earned some money. We are paid for that. Mm-hmm. But it was not like today that you can go to the library, you can go to mm-hmm. the record store and buy CDs. It was difficult. So we went to the embassies. That's why we knew Alvarez and Harry Parch, because the American embassy had lent us LPs and recording, the attaché culturel.
Yeah.
The same with the embassy of France. The first time I heard the Turangalila symphony by Messiaen is because they lent me an LP, 1962, 63, I don't know when. And then the Polish embassy and the German embassy. With those materials, we built our radio program, but we were learning.
At the same time.
At the same time. It all makes sense, more or less. At the Editela,
it makes a lot of sense, in fact.
My last project was for a composition for percussion ensemble and tape. But I don't think I did at the detail at the very, very end more than 10 seconds of the tape and probably one page of the composition, not much. It was a request from a percussion ensemble in Buenos Aires called Rhythmus, with whom we have collaborated many times in concerts. Mm-hmm. And I accepted the notion of writing for them. But then I left, went to New York. Mm-hmm. And in New York, I was a student under Yuzachevsky and doing very well. I met people. We started connecting with students from Juilliard, composition students, etc. And one day, a girl, Gita Steiner, she's no longer alive, she called me and said, "I'll see this. Will you come to the Manhattan School of Music tonight? They are doing one of my compositions with the percussion ensemble." So I went. Then she introduced me to Paul Price, who was the conductor of the percussion ensemble at the Manhattan School of Music. And a guy, very nice fellow, he said, "Well, Mr. Lanza, what are you doing? Have you ever written for percussion? You know, I could play your music." And so I told him about this project, and then he says, "Well, why don't you, this is 2 years later, but why don't you finish that project and I will premiere it for you?" So I wrote a piece in 1967 called Interferences 2 for 6 percussion players and tape, the tape done at Columbia Princeton, and is published by Boosey & Hawkes, but the dedicates are to the Rhythmus Percussion Ensemble in Buenos Aires and the Manhattan Percussion Ensemble in New York, to both of them, just to be fair. Okay?
Yeah, that's right.
And that was my second composition in New York with electronics. The first one was called Exercise 1. Obvious title. It was an exercise for me. I was trying to learn this type of laboratory, right? Mm. And that one also has a strange twist. So I did it, and it was 4 minutes and a half. And I have the idea that it should have dancers. That was it. Then, all of a sudden, we are getting mixed up with Copland again. I don't remember WBAI or the radio station from the Columbia University campus. Someone had a program where very successful, where they had an accomplished, famous composer mm-hmm. interviewing a young composer. And it was supposed to be Copland. Maybe they asked me or something. I said, "Well, he more or less knows me." But then at the 2 or 3 days before the radio broadcast, the producer called me and said, "Well, Mr. Copland cannot do it. Okay, he's sick or he's in Europe, blah, blah, blah. So the only one we can get, if you agree, is going to be Luciano Berio." Okay, I say, great. So I did it, and then we went to have a beer with Berio. And I think I managed to ask him. I said, well, you have heard my piece, Exercise 1. I'm trying to get more and more into electronics, and you are Luciano Berio. I said, can you just, this is outside the radio program. Tell me the truth. So he told me, the piece is too short. The materials are rich, and you are talking about lights and dancers. You should do something with that. And I followed his advice. So I went back to the studio and I made it. It's still called Exercise 1, but it's twice the length. It's almost 9 minutes now. And I finished my idea of the dancers, and it's called for electroacoustic music and self-generating choreography. I think it's a fantastic idea. It has been done like that. Mm. The self-generating choreography, it means probably influences from John Cage, okay, that I say, any number of people can do it, not necessarily dancers. But there's a sketch and it says each one is assigned a direction to walk back and forth, like a loop. Okay? Mm-hmm. The other dancer maybe goes like this, another one goes in circles. Okay? Mm-hmm. Each one has one task and one position. Maybe one is running, the other one is walking very slowly, etc. And spotlight aim from the ground up as to create large shadows. So the intersection, the interaction between the different pace and rhythm, etc., and the big shadows, it makes into a beautiful thing to look at.
I suppose.
So
yeah.
That piece exists thanks to Luciano Berio's suggestion. Mm.
So
have I arrived at music, more or less?
Yeah. You arrive at
okay.
the music.
So I am at Columbia Princeton. Vladimir Yuzachevsky, a big Russian guy born in Mongolia, he always adopted all the Latin Americans who couldn't speak English. He remembered when he arrived and he couldn't speak English. So he was like the father figure. Mm-hmm. I did very well as a student. Oh, let me tell you this. Mm-hmm. The class, 1965-66, where I was part of, included John Appleton, Jacob Drachmann, Charles Dodge, I think there were a couple of other big names.
Drachman, I think.
But Drachman didn't do much with electronic music, but he became a very important composer. George Flynn did quite a bit with electronics, etc. So it was kind of, again, a chosen class. I did very well, and I wanted to stay in New York. And so my fellowships were getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
The Guggenheim gave me a second year, but they reduced the stipendium. Then I got a fourth foundation fellowship, still smaller. And then the Organization of American States gave me a fellowship, still smaller. So I needed to have a job. And Yuzachevsky hired me as a technician, it was called, meaning that my job was to teach the new students how to operate the laboratory.
But why did you choose to study with Yuzachevsky?
Okay,
because
it's a good question.
Yeah, because I see the link between the Copland and the Guggenheim and all the stuff, but you have the possibility to choose to go to Juilliard or, I don't know, to study the piano. And you just said you just touch a little bit the electronics. So it was a big step, in fact.
Yes, but I wanted electronics, really. I applied for the Guggenheim to go and study electronics. There is an answer to your question. Mario Davidovsky. So we knew each other from 1956, probably. We were all very young. We also knew Kagel. Okay? Mm-hmm. Kagel, of that bunch, sorry about my English, is the only one that went to Europe. Okay? So with Mario Davidovsky, we used to go to the very trendy Calle Florida to drink espresso, and we were dreaming. we wanted to go to New York. We wanted to leave Argentina and go to New York to study electronic music, period. He did it first. Same path, Copland, Guggenheim, and he went to Colombia to study with Yuzachevsky. Mm-hmm. During a trip when he went back to visit his parents, etc., I think even Ginastera brought him during my 2 years to give one lecture or two on electronic music. So, or maybe when when I finally got the Guggenheim, maybe I wrote to him, mm-hmm. and he said, well, what I can tell you is, you got the Guggenheim, you like to come to New York, go to Colombia, this is what you have to do, and Yuzachevsky is a very good teacher. So it was at the recommendation of Mario Davidovsky.
Hmm.
Very clear.
And will you work with Yuzachevsky? You said it's a good teacher, but at the same time, the tape music was not a very developed technique. He developed it as during the time you was there, mm-hmm. in fact, I think, mm-hmm. With Milton Babbitt and some other person, I think. But so how was the technical aspect, and how did you help to develop it, or how all this was working at okay. this time?
Yuzachevsky has a very unusual way of teaching. First, we have to know that he have done already an enormous collection of recordings. Okay, and they were in the same room, twice the size of this room. There were all the tapes from Yuzachevsky there, of recordings he had done in the field, recording instruments, strange instruments, recording animals, recording and recopying at half the speed, at twice the speed with his comment. There was an enormous library. But he lectured. He will come to the class mm-hmm. and lecture. There was not much to listen from Europe, 1965, mm-hmm. only 10 years, right? But there was something, so he will play the example. But more than anything, it was examples from himself, from Otto Luening, compositions mm-hmm. by them, or Milton Babbitt, or maybe Davidovsky was already quite accomplished, okay? So he will analyze, he will take it apart, or maybe that day or that week, he says, the class is about ring modulation. Okay? He will go blah, 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 and give us all the notions of how this, and maybe mixing it up with the similarity between the theremin and other instruments in the past that have also worked with two different frequencies, okay? Mm-hmm. Even if the notion is completely different now.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual demonstrations were done by Ilhan Mimaroglu. He was a technician who taught me how to operate the machinery.
Oh.
He's a composer from Turkey that had gone through the same cycle, the same as me, but much earlier, studying with Yuzachevsky, mm-hmm. and he stayed there. The job of a technician meant that you got little money, but yeah. the studio was all there 24 hours for me. I could have as many hours as I wanted to work. I got the machinery. So did Mimaroglu. Mm? Mm. By the way, Mimaroglu is still alive.
Yeah, I know.
He must be 85, 86, like, yeah. okay? And he's still smoking. There was another guy from Turkey called Bülent Arel, but I have little contact because at that time he was already in New Haven, or I don't know where he went to teach. Mm. So Mimaroglu was the person that, at the request of Yuzachevsky, would have the oscillators tuned properly to do the demonstration about ring modulation, mm-hmm. filtering, phasing, whatever was needed. He will prepare the materials, the gadgets, the machinery in advance.
And we have to know it's very big. it was all this instrument was not so smaller as today. Today it's a kind of plug-in we can put in the computer.
Yes,
but
yes.
At this time it was they were all
what is called in English rack mountable, which means that they all have the same width, okay, yeah, with the screws. And like the ring modulators were already this tall. It was a long box like this.
Mm-hmm. 1 or 2 inch. Yeah.
Some of the filters were like this tall.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And they have at Columbia Princeton, as it is called, because of the project with computers, that was the Princeton part. They have very good filters. They have third of an octave filters called Albis. I love that instrument, no? With all these 32 or even more sliders, each one taking one-third of an octave. And you can put even white noise and start moving this, and it's music, okay? And then they have the Siemens, I think, filters that will, and also oscillators, that will sweep from 0 to 20,000 cycles without a multiplier.
Oh.
Okay? Those were very expensive. They were not in everyone's studio, but they did have them. And then the more common sine tone oscillator, square wave and pulse wave in the same machine, and ramp wave, all with multipliers.
Yeah.
Okay? And very useful.
And all this machine will work with lamps.
Yes. Okay. And they have a very good technician, James Seawright, who also built the mixers, the colorful mixer you were looking at before. And he was in charge of repairing, and he has 2 or 3 associates working under him. He will also invent machinery.
Because you have to invent at this time.
Yes.
A lot.
But the basic layout was very classical. So the Studio 106, that's where I was a student, that's where I was assigned for 6 years to be a technician and teach other people. Out of the 4 different studios, I was assigned to that one. It was called 106. So the layout was that in front of you is the mixer,
mm-hmm,
and all sorts of machinery. Here I get back to that later. But here you got 2 tape recorders and 2 other tape recorders. There were 4 tape recorders as a minimum. Mm-hmm. 2 were 2-track stereos, all Ampexes. And 2, you could change the head and it could be 4 tracks on 1/2 inch.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So they could all speak the same language if you wanted to. Okay. Or you could switch 1 or 2 to the 1/2 inch and have the 4-track configuration, mm-hmm, if you were working in 4 tracks. Some people did. Okay. All of them were under a speed control. And Jimmy Seawright had invented a push-button speed control device that was like a memory. So you could pre-program the changes of speed just with pushing or pulling buttons. Mm. Very, very handy. So that was the memory, because you could play back things already recorded,
mm-hmm,
and that was your storage. There was no other storage. If you like to keep something that was good, you better make a recording of it, okay? So that was the memory. And here in front of you on a big panel were an assortment of, as a minimum, 2 of each sine tone oscillators, 2 square wave oscillators, 2 ramp wave oscillators. They even have triangular wave, which is more exotic. 1 or 2 white noise generators. 1 was filter white noise. Sometimes they call it, I think, pink noise?
Yeah.
Yes, okay, because it already has some coloration. Ring modulators, okay. Phase modulators, whole bunch of gadgets to do things to sound. Mm. And in one corner in the back, there was something about, what is this, 1.5 feet wide, as tall as me, and probably 8 or 10 feet long. A huge rectangular box that was an echo chamber. And it was actually the later on famous EMT from Germany, echo chamber, but a primitive model. It was not portable at all. It was just physically there.
8 feet is quite...
And it had, this is funny, it's in my memory. I don't think it's in any of these pictures that I show you, probably not. It had, obviously, a microphone inside and a plate, okay? And the inputs and outputs were on the panel. So you could plug your things here, but they went there. But on the machine itself, there was a coat hanger wire, you know, coat hanger,
mm-hmm.
okay, with a piece of cardboard where Yuzhevsky has written 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 until 5 or 6 seconds. And there was another piece of cardboard that says something like, very delicate machine, don't shake it, don't mm-hmm. touch it, blah, blah, blah. So if you ever hear my piece, Exercise 1, the first sound, which is a big, clangorous, noisy sound, one day, by accident, I kicked the machine, and I loved the sound, so I finally put the tape recorder, and I kicked it again. I did what I was not supposed to have been done, and I like it so much that I kept it. That was my first sound, exercise one. I hope it's on the CEC listening list. So where are we now?
I'm curious to know... Because to ask you something about the aesthetical choice you made at this period, because you told me just a bit before that you doesn't want to know about Europe, what's happened in Europe. You was interested by USA and what's happened in the North. Why exactly? What was an appeal to you? Mm-hmm. An appeal to you? Because. As you know, the tape music was not so considerate in Europe, what we call tape music today. And at the same time, there was, it's a complete different point of view of the practice of electroacoustic. One used the sound as an abstract object and the tape music use it as a kind of extension of instrument. If I'm not wrong, I can...
Do you like a sip of Argentinian mate?
No, thanks.
Okay.
But so, what was the motivation you have for
well,
that?
We had to go back to Buenos Aires. Let's say all the time between.
I mean, in aesthetical term,
no.
What was the appeal like? L'appel.
It's both what me, or if I speak in plural, my friends, what we wanted, or the certainty of what we did not want, okay? I think we were very fortunate. All from the 1958 on, Argentina had a good moment of political stability. There was money. The radio stations used to work at that time, not anymore, the way it works here. We have our own groups for new music. We have our own cycles of concerts. Okay, we could go to the Argentinian Canada Council and ask money to do 4 countries, concerts in Teatro San Martin, all with lots of our music and contemporary music in general. And those programs, we could sell it to the national radio and they will pay the musicians.
Mm-hmm.
It was ideal. So we felt the need... perhaps to fill the gap that was needed there. No one else was doing it. So we were satisfying that need, but we were also learning. And we were learning, at least me, in both directions, knowing what I might want and knowing what I did not want. Okay? So the music coming from Darmstadt, that maybe the German embassy gave us recordings, did not interest us too much, or me. The music from Poland with the early Penderecki, okay, that interest, Dobrowolski, that was interesting. It was one way to learn. But in any case, the general image we have of Europe Because we used to go to the coffee shops and have a cappuccino and talk. And, you know, it's, you are young, you want to make progress in your career as a composer, etc. We were dreaming. So the general image was that Europe was pushing for 12-tone music and total serialization. It was Darmstadt and Adorno, and after Schember and Weber, and then Boulez, okay? And we didn't want that. I was more interested in the crazy things that John Cage was doing, or the sounds of Varese. It has nothing to do with 12-tone or after 12-tone music.
And with the question of musique concrète and tape,
we didn't know.
You didn't know. So you didn't have the. So you compare from an aesthetical point of view, aesthetical point of view. In fact,
I think you're right. For me, it's easier, if I try to remember the way I was thinking, to find the contrast between the 12-tone and post-12-tone, total serialization, still working with notes and intervals, compared with the indeterminacy, the freedom of the works of the time by John Cage or Morton Feldman, Edgar Varese, is God. Mm-hmm. Okay. But unfortunately, I don't remember if the French embassy gave us enough examples of early musique concrète, because there is not much time. Is when the name becomes established, it's not even 1948 anymore. You need or Pierre Schaeffer, Pierre Henry. They needed half a dozen years.
Oh yeah, I know.
Already 1956, and then we had our radio programs already, and doing our concerts. And 8 years later, I am in New York. So the time constriction is severe. But I will say probably the French embassy gave us some examples of musique concrète that we use in the radio program. Must have been, but it's not here today.
Okay.
So you see, I can speak for me, for Tauriello, for Krieger, for Etkin, who is much younger, of that generation of composers. Now, Kager, he chose to go to Germany. He accepted the Darmstadt. Of course, he did whatever he wanted, because he's Le Théâtre Musical, right?
Of course.
But we didn't know that. Mm-hmm. By the way, Kager gave me my first job as a paid pianist in Buenos Aires when he was a student, still there, 1958. He couldn't find anyone that could play the second piano sonata by Roger Sessions from the United States, ultra serialization, very difficult. I did it. But then he went to Europe, I went to New York. Okay, the aesthetic situation is a good question. I am in New York. I am interested in kicking the EMT echo chamber. I am interested in noise, in writing for percussion. But because of Davidovsky's recommendation, I am part of Columbia Princeton. And Babbitt is only two doors away. The university or the music department had a performance ensemble directed by two, at the time, young composers, Charles Warinen and Harvey Solberger. But for them, the music has to be written with notes and intervals, and has to be written in 6/8 or 4/4. I was lost because they refused to play my music. But it was not only me. It was George Flynn and John Appleton. So finally, we formed our own group called the Columbia Composers Group, and that's where they did some of my early pieces. And John Appleton's, because the official group with Warinen and Solberg that had accepted Davidovsky, very good friend, refused to do our music.
Hmm.
So it was aesthetic divergence there.
Yeah, a kind of clash, in fact.
Yeah. And I was very naive at the beginning. The first year, I say, oh, they have such good performers. These guys are crazy. So I wrote a piece, also called Interference, for 8 wind instruments and tape, because that was the ensemble for that year of Solberger and Vuorinen. And they, I think they even did some promotion that they were looking for composition that will fit that ensemble. I wrote it. The piece exists. I even compromised because it's not in 4-4, but I put a few notes. I gave them the score. To today, they have never said thank you. They never played. They ignored me completely. So I started relating. That was uptown. I started relating with the downtown, where I had my friends. When the whole thing with Steve Reich, and it was cooking. It was right there. I knew John Cage from Buenos Aires already. So I knew Earl Brown. I interviewed them. The interviews exist. I was among friends. Earl Brown gave me my first recording because he directed the mainstream records for jazz and for contemporary music. And he used to come to, we finally did our own performance group. Okay, yeah. Was called the Composers Performers Group in New York. And he used to come to our concerts. So one day he said, Alcides, I think that you have the qualifications. Why don't we talk about doing an LP of Latin American music? And I did it. Exists.
Yeah, I know.
Last year I looked at it on eBay and it was selling for $50.
Yeah, it's quite expensive now.
I think the guy got the $50 because I checked last week and it's not there anymore.
No, no.
Okay, so those were my friends. Babbitt. When I finished my studies with Yuzachevsky, I told him, well, I'm thinking about what to do next year. I need your opinion because after this, the logical step seems to be getting involved with a computer music project and Mr. Babbitt. And Yuzachevsky says no. He says, Babbitt is going to demand that you take 2 years of higher mathematics before letting you touch the humongous RCA synthesizer. So during the years, after the 106 room, at one point I had to teach on another laboratory. And here was my lab. On the door in front of it was Babbitt's room. The only connection with Babbitt was that he will enter in the morning, says good morning, and then he will leave and he will say good night. Or if you went and you pick up the telephone and the call was for Babbitt, you had to knock at the door. There was no other, he didn't want to talk, not with me, with anyone. So it was part of the aesthetic divorce. I did not want to do that type of so precisely programmed digital computer music that he was doing because it was an extension of total serialization. And I didn't want that. I was truly interested in sound like this and noise. I love noise.
How can you describe, just to finish with this question of USA, when you pass to the USA and it's begin to form you as a mixed composer, because I notice you do a lot of mixed music. I think it's a good appellation in English. Okay. What is for you what we call in the book, as you know, the American tape music?
The American tape music?
Yeah, because if you notice, I don't know if you notice that, but they consider the electronic music born in three ways. You have the concrete ways, where you manipulate the object and just do music by erase all the trace of its origin. You have the electronic ways, where they try to do music, as Stockhausen said, but with oscillator and all this stuff. And you have this image, because I think it's an image, we don't know exactly what it is, of the tape music with Mimaroglu first, but Ushasevsky, Lehan, and all this person. There's so few tapes who still exist of that we just have Milton Babbitt and all this kind of person, but we don't have any idea of the aesthetic, general aesthetic, who was not prevalent, but were driving the composer, in fact. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to hear you about
Well, the
that.
Influence on me was obviously coming from Imaroglu and Jussachevsky. In both cases, they accepted working with the sound object and working with recording. However, I have to tell you this because it's rather incredible. They have one, in each studio, one Neumann microphone. Very good. But it was guarded under key. And in order to use it, you have to write a memo, ask permission. That, in a way, tells you parts of the story. So Jussachevsky has done lots of field recordings, so he was in favor of recording sound, noises, animals. And he used that in his composition. So he was not against it. Certainly, my interest with noise, I was working with him in those years, and he let me do. He never discussed what I was doing. Neither did Mimaroglu. Now, they did quite a bit of trying to find the proper frequency arrangement for with oscillators to what was characteristic, what will approach a piano sound, what will be an approximation to a trumpet sound, which maybe is a little bit closer to Germany. But they didn't force that into us. It was part of the general knowledge. It was free composition.
Okay? More free than in Europe, in fact.
Could be.
Like that, I think.
But I, from the beginning, even the piece I started in Buenos Aires was already not only involving noise, was supposed to be...
So they blend, in fact, they do more electroacoustic music, as we know mm-hmm. the term,
yeah.
before there was this conjunction in the Europe, right?
Or that I don't know if it's before or not.
But I mean, in the spirit, mm-hmm. possibly yes. Eh? Okay.
My interest in mixing the live instrumentalist or ensembles
with tape.
Yeah,
that's my next question.
I don't know. I always wanted to do it. I thought it was a natural extension, analog instrumental music, to have the electronic component. I also jumped very, very early into live electronics.
Yeah, that was my question. Why did you stay, because you were so interested in noise, why did you stay in with this new form of art, we can call it like that, with an old form of art? Excuse me the term, because it's not connected, but it's a question who intrigued me, because mm-hmm. why, I don't know. So explain a little bit more to me, please.
Well, I don't know if I can explain, but I felt the need to write for instruments accompanied by tape. And the early version of all those pieces from the 60s, I still call them not only with tape. It says for piano and electronic sounds. And at one point, if I was able to revise anything, I prefer electroacoustics, because... sometimes they were truly electronics. In many occasions, they were not electronics. So I started liking it less. But that will be a fixed electroacoustic part on tape.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But from 1967 on, you can find several of my compositions done in New York that have a tape, but it also requires the singer or the instrumentalist to be amplified and to be modified in real time. That's live electronics, what we call now digital signal processing. And when I use some of that, I use the term electronic extensions. So it will say, for example, for voice, piano, electroacoustic sounds, and electronic extensions. And I still like it, even today, much better than digital signal processing. I think that electronic extensions is what it is. It's an extending the potential of electronics via electronics.
Mm.
But It's only me using that expression, not too many other composers.
Yes. Yeah, but at the same time, it's revealed something. You consider the electroacoustic as a kind of complement, as a complement of the acoustic sound, mm-hmm. or vice versa.
Yeah, it could happen either way. Okay, I don't know. It's difficult to analyze oneself.
Give me some cue about how did you perceive it, maybe, or something like, if you can explain it.
I don't think I can. I just wrote the compositions and they all exist and they get performed. In one case is the fixed situation because the tape part is fixed. It would only go one way. I experimented by putting different cues, so the ensemble could, or the soloist could play without the restriction of the tape, faster or slower, but then Q1, the tape, you get to follow the clock, so to say. I don't know, I look for ways to make it less fixed. But the electronic extensions is a natural development because it's things that I can do on the singing voice or the clarinet that cannot be done unless it's done in real time. And I needed that, so I just did it.
Okay, so we'll